Welcome to the Make Life Less Difficult podcast. This podcast explores what it means to make life less difficult for each other and for ourselves. We share stories of struggles and successes because we believe sharing our stories eases the difficulty of life. I'm Lisa Tilstra, your host. Let's jump into today's conversation. My guest today is Amy Achata. Amy is a clinical mental health counselor. She believes meaningful connection changes people, and this is what the therapeutic process is about. Amy is passionate about encouraging growth and restoration for those questioning their purpose or identity and searching for meaning. Amy works with people facing grief and loss, generational trauma, religious trauma, anxiety, identity questions, and much more. Amy has multiple degrees, including two bachelor's degrees in addition to her master's. She spent a number of years focusing on raising her two children as her family moved all over the United States, and now they reside in the Chattanooga, Tennessee area. Amy likes to knit, read, practice yoga, sip coffee, and have deep, meaningful conversations and connection. Her favorite place on earth is the beach. Amy and I have known each other from a distance for many years through her husband, David, who has been a guest on my podcast. But it has been an absolute pleasure to connect more with Amy and learn more about her journey and story. And I'm honored to host this conversation with her here today. Amy, thank you so much for your willingness to connect, for your authenticity and exploration of life, emotions, growth, and deep connections. I look forward to more conversations with you both on the podcast and hopefully just enjoying sipping coffee as we chat as well. If you are in the Chattanooga area and you're looking for a counselor, Amy is practicing at Scout Counseling and is currently taking in-person clients. Her contact information is in the show notes. Please feel free to reach out. Amy, welcome to the Make Life Less Difficult podcast.
Thanks, Lisa. I'm glad to be here.
I am really looking forward to jumping into this conversation, Amy, because you are someone that I feel like I have known of for a long time, but I haven't actually met until we actually never even talked, which almost, I don't know, it seems like we should have in the past because our lives somehow have crossed. But when we talked to say, hey, will you be on my podcast? It was kind of like, I think we're just meeting, but I also feel like I sort of know you. It's this interesting dynamic. But all of that to say, I'm really looking forward to truly getting to know you better through our conversation today.
Same here. Yes, I share those sentiments.
So as we jump in, I have a question that I ask all of my guests around this idea of making life less difficult. The name of the podcast, the work I do, comes from a quote by Mary Ann Evans. What do we live for if not to make life less difficult for each other? And I would love to hear, when you hear that, what does it mean?
Well, to start, that resonates in my heart. I love that quote. And I think that it has a lot to do with the way that I live my life, because what it means to me, and in particular for the work that I'm doing now, is the way that I like to think about making life less difficult is showing people that they're not alone. I think that difficulty is unavoidable, unfortunately, though wouldn't we love to be able to avoid it? And we have a capacity within all of us, regardless of what we're doing for occupation, to be with each other in it, to help shoulder the burden. Even if it's just saying, hey, I know I can do nothing here to make this feel better. I know I can say nothing that makes this better. And I can just sit with you in it and help you hold it. So that was largely absent in my life, especially as a child. I got left alone to deal with confusing and difficult things. Mm-hmm. And now I might not have physically been alone, but often emotionally I felt alone, mm-hmm. because no one was willing to engage in the conversations. I was the baby of the family, and I've learned recently, and as I've gotten older, my family was trying to protect me because I was the baby. But unfortunately, what that did is that isolated me. And it left me with zero tools as a child to make sense of what was happening. And of course, my body could feel all of it, right? Mm. I knew that things were not as they should be. Mm. But no one was speaking into that story. And so I was alone to try to make sense of it, which unfortunately now I know as an adult and with my training in counseling and psychology, right? A child will automatically assume that it is their fault.
Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah.
Every time. Because they have nothing else. They can't put that responsibility on their parents because they need their parents to be good.
Mm-hmm.
They have to have them for survival.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the fault turns inward. Unfortunately, that is what I did, but with no awareness and no one speaking into that. There was lots of meaning making made in isolation that was never checked by me with anyone that would know better or different.
Yeah.
And so I spent so much of my life just in pain and shame and confusion. So the way that translates into my work as a counselor today is I love to encourage and explicitly tell people, wow, that sounds really hard. Or this is breaking my heart to hear this story. And also gently, when the time is right, offering a little reframe.
Yeah.
Often in the form of question, could there have been anything else?
Yeah.
And questioning the meaning that people have made out of their own experiences, because that's been so healing for me. And then just to make space, safety, and provide an empathetic listening ear and that connection, right? That so often when we're in our worst and hardest moments, connection is lacking.
Yes.
So the short answer to your question is making life less difficult to me means offering connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's so vital to well-being, and we know that and we don't know that all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like we know it. And yet I certainly experience this in my own life. As deeply as I know it and I have experienced it, there's something in me that also sometimes resists it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think we all do. It's like the thing we need. And oh, no. Well, because it's scary for one, it's vulnerable.
Yeah.
So there's a push-pull ambivalence, I think, in all of us.
Yeah. For sure. I'm glad I'm not alone in that.
Yeah.
It's helpful to know, right? Like,
yes.
Yeah. And there's so much wisdom in what you've shared already, Amy. And I really want to hear so much more about your story and your journey. I want to briefly just tell you how much it resonates when you say, you know, knowing we're not alone is so important. And that connection piece, because that really is the foundation of why I do this podcast of saying, hey, you know what? If one person hears a story, if one person listens to our conversation today and can connect and resonate and feel less alone, it doesn't fix the difficulty. It doesn't make life easy. It's no magic potion or wand. It can make the difficult times a little less difficult. And to me, that's like, okay, great. Success. Like that's because I've experienced it in my own life, right? Where I hear somebody's story and I realize in that moment, oh my goodness, I'm not alone. I'm not going crazy. Mm-hmm. Somebody gets it. And that time and time and time and time again makes the difficult times less difficult, allows me to know I'm not alone. And that's incredibly powerful.
It is. And that touches on the most prevalent theme amongst those that I counsel, is them saying, regardless of the situation that they've gone through or are currently in, saying, I'm not crazy. Mm. Like, I just need to know I'm not crazy.
What is it? Yeah. What is it in us that makes us? Because I countless times that I've been like, oh, I must be just going crazy. And it's common, right? Like anytime I say that to somebody else, they're like, oh yeah, you know, I felt that too. Or that when I do start sharing and then somebody says like, oh, okay, I'm not going crazy. Or what is it in us that makes us think that we're crazy for whatever we're thinking, feeling, experiencing?
I don't know the ultimate answer to that question, but some of the things that come to mind, Lisa, is for one, we're the easiest target of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Right. And then if that is the answer, I think that underneath it, there might be some wild hope that we can have some control over that.
Mm-hmm. Do you find it's more of a prominent internal dialogue for women than men?
Mm-mm. Both. I don't think so. Yeah. I think it's both. It seems to be, not that I've done a large empirical study.
Yeah.
But it seems to be a universal human experience that the doubt turns first on ourselves. Mm. And the other piece of that is there is a part of the human experience that makes us feel like we're alone.
Yeah.
Our situation, I think it seems somehow unique to everyone else. Like, okay, for some reason, I alone, you know, I've had these circumstances. I have this personality. I have this story. I have et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That seems to be a piece of it. Mm-hmm. This feeling of uniqueness, individuality, which is true in a way, right? Because we all do. The thing about trauma, for instance, is it's not the event, it's the internal personal experience of the person, whether it's traumatic or not, whether it has a lasting effect or not. So it's, I think those are the most insidious lies, is the ones that are really close to the truth or have a piece of the truth in them.
Mm, yeah.
Those are tricky.
Extremely tricky. Yeah. And you can very easily just kind of, it's an internal tweaking just a little bit that takes it from truth to lie. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I laugh at myself because in the midst of COVID was the time most prominent that I had this self-awareness of being, you know, just kind of like down and feeling alone and nobody understands. And then I was like, I just remember laughing at myself of like, wait a minute, Lisa, this is a global pandemic. I'm pretty sure there's somebody else out there who gets it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. At least the common experience, their details might be different.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
And the there's feelings, emotions.
Yes, there's a saying I've heard where the more specific our story, the more universal our story.
Huh. Oh, I love that. Yeah, which is counter to what we're just saying, right? Like, there's a piece of us or a part of us that believes like, oh, no one else will understand. This is so unique. Mm-hmm. I alone am in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think doesn't that point, Lisa, to the absolute necessity of connection and community, that almost immediately we can at least internally spiral to, I'm alone and I'm crazy for thinking this, right? Like that is showing me the absolute vital necessity of being connected to people.
Yeah.
I mean, when you just think about mental illness and you think about the worst of those, right? The worst of those mental illnesses. You think about the justice system. And what is the absolute worst punishment is solitary confinement.
Yeah.
Right? People lose their mind quickly, very quickly when they're out of connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
Amy, I would love if this idea, right, of connection, looping that back to what you were sharing about growing up and feeling an isolation and a disconnection. And you alluded to retelling, reframing, learning, right, about yourself and your journey. I would love to invite you to share, jump in where it makes sense, because I am so curious to know more about your journey from that place, even just how you came to an awareness of what you experienced as a child and its impact on you. And then the, I don't know how you would describe, like the unraveling of some of those stories and beliefs as a child and shaping those into more productive and life-giving beliefs and systems as an adult.
Yeah, that's been quite a process and a journey, one that I'm still on. But a few things came to mind. Like if I were to give you little snapshots. So one snapshot that fueled sort of the alone feeling and the disconnection for me was actually came before I was born. In utero, there was a crisis in my family and an intimate betrayal. And I was in my mother's womb when this happened, and there was great distress, stress, fear, etc. Was literally swimming in stress hormones. And the result of that, or one of the results of that, that has played a big piece throughout my entire existence, is that I absorbed all of that anxiety. And when I was born, guess what? I was needy. I was easily upset. I was stressed. Even as a baby, my family describes it, that I was a worrier. So that sort of set the stage, right? It gave me that start. Then think about childhood attachment and the necessity of a child to have a consistent attachment with their caregiver, to know that they're reliable. And the other piece of that is a regulation. A baby, a child cannot regulate themselves. They depend upon literally the regulation of the people around them. So to have a dysregulated family, mom desperately loving me and desperately wanting to do her best, and yet fearing for her own future, for her relationship, vacillating between despair and fear. So the consistency was not there. The regulation was not there. And so that further impacted me and set the foundation, right, for how was I going to interact with the world? How was I going to see myself, other people, and my place and in the world? And it was often fearful, even as a child. And so add on to that years of, like I had mentioned before, because I was the youngest, there was the desire of my family to protect me from the pain, from the things that were happening. And so there was just an absence of story. I was just living in this really strange, weird vacuum where people were pretending that things were okay, at least for my, for my benefit, so to speak, but nothing was okay. And so my nervous system was confused. My brain was confused. Like the people that I am supposed to be able to trust are telling me this story, but my body is telling me a different story. And nothing can integrate those because no one was willing to speak and tell me the truth. So that began a split for me, a dual life, so to speak. Mm. My body is telling a story, but I guess I can't trust it.
Mm.
Because everyone else is feeding me a different story. And that goes into that piece of, am I crazy? Mm-hmm. It's me. Oh, I'm the only one. There's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
I must be broken. So that played into so much of my story and just got reaffirmed and reiterated in a thousand ways. So another piece that sort of exacerbated this story for me was that we were deeply embedded in a very legalistic, like fundamentalist religion. Mm. There were black and white answers. There was a heavy reliance on behavior and appearance. So I learned very young that to be accepted and to get approval, which was the closest thing that I could feel to love, right? And belonging, especially in that whole culture, because it was my schools, my church, my family. For me, there was nothing else. This was my entire world, right? So it just taught me to pretend and to hide anything that wasn't acceptable. Any questions, any doubts, those weren't welcome. I was not to ask.
Mm.
For one, that would be disrespecting my parents, right? So, because it's very, what translated from the religion to my family of origin was authoritative parenting.
Okay.
This is the answer. This is my word.
Mm.
Do not question. Do not push back. That would be disrespect. And then that's upheld with scripture, right? Mm. Honor your father and your mother, which meant they could do no wrong.
Mm. And disrespecting parents equal disrespecting God, which makes it even more intense.
Oh, yeah. Oops. Absolutely. Yeah. So you see the conundrum I was in.
Uh-huh.
Like, how can you even be a human?
Yeah.
Right? Like that strips you of your humanity. I mean, like at the most basic level, it's agency.
Yes.
Well, there was no agency. And then I learn, you know, as an adult, like what that type of system, you know, whether it's religious or not, right? Any like authoritative system where it's tyrannical, you know, you don't question, or it's some kind of rebellion. And what that does in your body, in your biology, is it separates you from your body. It has to, because your body is telling you different messages, and that's dangerous. So for survival, you have to cut yourself off from that. So that just furthered my disconnection from the body. And then specifically the messages about sexual purity.
Mm.
And what that meant, and denial of so many of the normal, natural, healthy bodily responses to growing up.
Mm.
So that furthered that message, and just really was sort of a perfect storm for me of lacking personal identity. That was just non-existent, because basically the message I got was the less individual you can be, the better.
Wow.
It's like, don't be too much you. Don't show emotion. Don't, you know, the uniqueness, all of those things, the message that I interpreted it as was the less you are, the better.
Wow.
Fit maybe be someone else.
Fit into this mold.
Yeah. And it was a very tight, inflexible mold.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which is so hard for kids, right? Because I just think about kids are so, I mean, they're just exploring the world. They're experimenting. Every day is an experiment for kids. So they learn and grow, and they can't.
Well, and it's, they need to.
Yeah.
Like it's a necessary piece of development.
Yeah.
And to have that sort of truncated or short-circuited, it is damaging.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really damaging. I think I got a little bit lost in my own story there, but those were some of the snapshots of growing up, that like the pieces of the story that seem important and fundamental.
Yes, to it strikes me, Amy, as you're sharing that, especially, you know, here in the last couple of minutes, of just reflecting on the fact that kids are, they don't know themselves. They don't know the world, right? So every day in developing, it's all experimenting and learning and growing. And that place of not having that freedom to explore, or it's only accessible within these very tight boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in that, that's the norm. So I'm assuming at the time, like you had no idea as a child that there's anything that's dysfunctional or there's any problem with this, right? Like I can't remember when, but like as a kid, one time, like going to somebody else's house and experiencing a different family vibe, mm-hmm. having this sort of awakening moment of, oh, my family's way is not the only way to do things, right? Because as a kid, it's like, oh, that's all I know, and that's the norm, and that's my world. So I don't know if that resonates, right? Like, because I think we grow up as kids, and sometimes in very dysfunctional environments, and have no idea they're dysfunctional. They're functional. They're normal for us, even though they're quite dysfunctional if we zoom out. Does that make sense?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Right. It does make sense. And I think in response to your description of sort of that mental awakening you mentioned of, oh, there are other ways to do this, was one of the pieces of my story is that both of my parents, having gone through their own traumas, and there's a lot to that, like just as a tiny window, that my dad was a Korean war baby born near Seoul, Korean mother, UN soldier, never known the identity of, was taken to an orphanage, adopted to America. I mean, like there's so much to the story and the trauma of, that fed into my family growing up, of very inflexible two parents who were very perfectionistic. And the message was, no, actually, this is the only way.
Mm.
And that was, again, almost like highlighted, made stronger, exacerbated by the religion in which we were a part of. This is the only way.
Mm.
This is the only way to God. This is the only way to eternal life.
Mm.
So there was that was trickling down into my family system of, this is the only way to live. So even when I would see other things, it was almost like a judgment or they haven't figured this out, or they're, even as a child, passing judgment, because that's all I was seeing from my parents and from the authorities in the church. Was judging people who are different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that threatens your belonging. If you are different, if I am different, I will not belong.
Right.
Well, and as a child, you can't have that, right? You have to belong or you will die.
Yes.
So all of that was going on. And I stayed in that system, believe it or not, till 12 years ago. And it's a very difficult thing to get out of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, not considered by the strict definition of a cult, and yet so cultish.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, this is the only way, the indoctrination. And granted, that varied depending on what family you were in. But my particular family really just like wholeheartedly ascribed to that way of living. Say, for instance, like one of the crazy pieces of that, right? Like, now that I'm out of it, can see how crazy and how wrong that can go so quickly, right? I was 16 years old, and my grandma, this was my dad's adopted mom, American mom. She was eccentric, and actually now as an adult, I would say that she probably had some personality disorder, mental health things going on because of her behavior. But at the time, I didn't know that. I just thought she was a little crazy. But she had taken these extremes of the religion and just kept going down the path, and had become convinced that David Koresh and the Branch Davidians had the corner on truth. Aww. And this was at the time when David Koresh was actually, he was traveling the United States. He was recruiting for Waco for the compound. And she was going to see him, and she had tickets, and she called me and invited me to go.
Wow. And you said you were 16.
16 years old. And this is my grandmother, right? Like,
yeah.
What a difficult thing. Okay. So here she says to me, this is the truth. This is the direction we all need to be going. You need to leave the system that your family's part of. I'm 16. Why are you talking to me about this? Like, talk to my parents, not me. Yeah. But anyway, she's like, will you come with me? You need to come with me. And, I refused her. Aww. No, thank you. You know, and she, flipped a switch. I mean,
oh wow.
She started getting very heated and aggressive, and it went to, you are going to hell because aww. you're lost. You're in the wrong camp.
Oh,
I didn't even know what to do with that. Right?
No,
like the phrase, like, okay, like, all right, grandma, like I'm going to hang up now.
Wow. I'm gonna hang up.
But that's just an example of, I'm trying to like iterate where that can go so quickly from where we were.
Yes.
Yeah. I was like, eh. Of course, then later when all the things happened with Waco, it's like, oh my word.
Yeah. And how close you were to that, right? With your grandmother saying, come, let's go listen to David Koresh. And yeah, no, it's intense.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that was just a little piece of crazy in my story.
Yeah. When did you start to form awareness of all of like what you went through as a child, and sounds like as a teenager and being in that system?
Yeah, well, I just kept getting put in deeper and deeper places. So David, my husband, was in school to be a pastor and in this denomination, and he was hired after he graduated. We got married, and he became a pastor at a large church. And though it was on the liberal end of this, and considered itself, it was sort of the black sheep of the religion, so to speak. Here I was as a new mom, you know, a new wife. I'm put in the position now. Can you see sort of the ratcheting up in my life?
Mm.
Of the expectations and the roles and the, so here I am, a pastor's wife in this denomination, and just trying to right, to do my best and to be a good wife and be a good mom and all those things. And, but it did start becoming an issue that I couldn't ignore anymore. I was really good at putting my head in the sand, like an ostrich. I am, on the Enneagram, I'm a one, I'm a rule follower, the good person, right? I love boundaries. I like consistency. It actually makes me feel quite safe most of the time to know what's expected of me. But the weight was getting heavier and heavier with the more roles put on me.
Yeah, lots of expectations.
Yes, and becoming too heavy. Mm. So things were coming out sideways. And what I mean by that is, though I couldn't admit in my mind yet what was happening, I was suffering physically. I had chronic migraines. I was, not sleeping well. Mm. Anxiety. I had anxiety dreams, nightmares. I was getting more and more, I would say, almost like social anxiety, though I couldn't have put that term on it at the time, because I felt like so much was expected of me.
Wow.
So much perfection. Mm. And it was getting tiring.
Yes, that will.
And I was getting to the end of myself. And so I was breaking down. I was crying. I was feeling completely lost. I would say depressed, but I wouldn't have ever used that word at the time because that wasn't acceptable. But I was.
Yeah.
Because I felt trapped and I didn't see hope. I couldn't see how it could change or get better.
Yeah.
And so that was very confusing to me because I had all of the things that I had ever wanted. I had a loving husband who supported me and wanted the best for me and us. I had two beautiful children that I was just completely in love with. Mm. And I was a disaster emotionally. Wow. And I just couldn't make any sense of it. I couldn't make the connection. So I became more and more anxious. And I became more and more depressed. All the while, I think that here the split between my body and mind was probably just getting greater and greater because I was on autopilot. I could do all the right things. Mm. Oh, and I was good at it.
Mm.
And inside, I felt more and more dead.
Mm.
But I just had no words. I had no framework. I had nothing to make any sense of all that.
Yeah. So you just keep going through the motions.
Yeah. Because what do?
Yeah.
You just keep going.
Yeah. Until when? Like, what was it that changed that?
Well, unfortunately, it was a really slow, painful process. And I laugh because I don't know what else to do. In hindsight, it's like, wow, Amy, like how stubborn and how, in a way it's like, you want to say that, but I didn't know any better. So long story, but we're convinced that God was calling us out of that church and that denomination and that world, which really was our whole world, both of us, because we had been born into it and grown up in it. So all of our friends and all of our family and all of our support system.
Mm.
And, we resigned, David resigned. We uprooted our family and moved all the way across the continental United States.
Wow.
And that was a lot, very difficult. Of course, I was, struggling through trying to rectify and justify leaving this belief system. So that was heavy.
Yeah.
And the depression for me just got worse and worse. Mm-hmm. And the anxiety was getting worse and worse. And it was affecting me more and more physically. And thankfully, we became part of a community that began to speak truth and life into me. Mm-hmm. And I began to get the glimpse of another way to live. And the mental picture that I had was that my entire life I had been being buried alive.
Wow.
And more weight in, you know, the dirt here, if I was literally being buried in the ground alive, was just heavier and heavier and more suffocating. And I was barely conscious. And then this community, the mental picture is that finally the first shovelfuls of dirt were being removed.
Wow.
So it was quite a process. And then to come to the complete end of myself where I said, I am so wounded that I need help. I need professional help. I need medication because I couldn't function. So I began a process of counseling, seeing a counselor, and I got prescribed medication for depression and anxiety just to see if I could get some sort of a foothold, anything.
Yeah.
And those things together combined with the new awareness of God's care for me and love for me as an individual, as me, like that I could actually be me and that would not mean rejection and abandonment. And so part of the work for me then was to find out who Amy was, because I did not know.
Wow.
It was a version of me that was living. But it was the version where I had denied myself. I had denied who God had made me to be individually. I had silenced or attempted to silence my body, my emotions, my thoughts, my feelings, anything that rocked the boat.
Didn't fit in the mold.
Yeah. And so it was a very tedious, long process to find myself. Like, who am I? What do I care about? What do I like to do? What are my actual thoughts? To find my voice, that was a big thing, because as I got older, I just got quieter and quieter in that system. So I had to find my voice. And that is actually something that is still a challenge for me to speak, especially when I know that the person will not agree or like what I'm going to say. So that is currently still some of the work that I'm doing. So it's not in all arenas of life, but in specific situations where it's really difficult for me to speak and show up authentically. Because it still feels scary.
Yes. And, you know, a friend of mine talks about the blueprint that has been put in our brain as kids, right? And so hearing you describe your childhood where it's like, here's the mold, stay in this little mold where you are not disrupting anybody around you or not pushing back. That's the blueprint, right? So it makes total sense then as an adult, even though you've identified these different things and you're, you know, discovering yourself and your voice, it makes sense that it still would be incredibly difficult and a challenge to push back in certain situations and speak up. Yeah, that makes really good sense.
Yeah. And to show up the way that I really want to show up, because there was so much of this stereotypical role of what a woman should be, right? The perfect woman, right? Serve everyone. Yeah, you know, this comes with religion, but also society. I mean, you are to be quiet. and to follow your leader, right? And you are to fit this, yeah, again, a mold, right?
Yes.
Cook, clean, raise the children, play the piano. I mean, you know, you could go on and on, right? About what that means.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, that just was never me, but was what I trained myself to do to get approval and acceptance. And even that though, you know, I know now that's fake, that approval. It doesn't actually make you feel like you belong, because guess what? No one knows you.
Right. Right. It's just, it's the act. It's the mask that you put on.
Yeah. No one actually knows you.
Yeah.
And no one can.
Yeah.
So it's a lonely place to be.
Yeah. What you're describing, Amy, there's a part of, for me, that comes back to the name of the podcast and the theme of the podcast, Making Life Less Difficult. And I think, you know, what you're describing and the transition from being in a place where you're just, you're performing and you've got the mask and you're checking the boxes because other people expect it, but inside you're collapsing and imploded and really disconnected mind and body. And then to start working your way out of that, discovering who you are, learning new ways of interacting both with yourself and others. This is one of these things that I think this is really difficult. There's no magic wand, right? I mean, you mentioned a few minutes ago, this is a journey you continue to be on. What and who have helped make the difficulty a little less difficult for you in this journey?
Yeah. There have been a few things that have really helped. I've mentioned two of them already, and that was counseling. So my counselor, I've been with the same counselor now for 7 years, almost seven, six and a half. And a consistent advocate for me from the beginning. Medication. Not that I think medication fixes anything, but for me, it has given me enough help just to allow me the space to begin doing the work.
Yeah, makes sense.
Right. The third thing, and I can't put these in order of importance because they've all worked in tandem for me, but the third thing has been yoga. That is the practice that has given me a way to reconnect with my body and to teach me to be present, to not dissociate. I used and have used dissociation throughout my life extensively just to make it bearable. So I met a dear friend of mine now. She wasn't then, of course, when I first met her, but she, actually, she is a Christian and she taught a Christ-centered yoga practice once a week. And I started with her. That was the beginning of my journey of learning about yoga and learning about my body and learning what does it feel like to stay in it. So that was pivotal. And I've practiced yoga now for just over 6 years and still nothing else comes close to me for healing. And, another piece for me is I'm a big learner. I love to learn. So I read all the time, multiple books at a time. I am learning about, I was fascinated with trauma and what it does to your body because of how much, somatic symptoms I had had dealt with throughout my life. So I needed to learn about that. I needed to know what was actually happening. It felt like knowing would then give me some self-compassion, and also then allow me to begin drawing a new blueprint. You're talking about that blueprint of your mind, right? Yeah. So yoga played a piece in that. Counseling played a piece in that. I think the medication played a piece in that, quite literally in the chemicals in the brain. Wow. And then the learning and the knowledge, and then of course I went to school to get my master's in counseling. So that also was a piece of my healing journey, was just a greater understanding. But the piece too that was vital for me that I mentioned was self-compassion. I had none. I mean, like, if we could put me on the negative end of the spectrum, my inner critic, of course, growing up in the system that I had grown up in of perfectionism and legalism and so much attention on behavior, I just had zero compassion for myself. And the critic, the inner critic, was running the show. And so to learn to grant myself grace and compassion was huge. It's pivotal. The work of Kristen Neff and Chris Germer and combining that with my yoga practice has been transformational.
Wow.
Literally.
Wow.
But you asked about people, and there have been several people. David has been a champion and cheerleader and just the biggest supporter, and always like wanting me to heal and grow and feel safe. And so that if it were not for him championing me, I would not have. I wouldn't be where I am. I just couldn't on my own. So he's a great encouragement. And there have been a few others, especially in our Soma family of churches, that have really spoken into my life and continue to do that. Jeff and Janie Vanderstelt, Abe and Jen Meisenberg, to name a couple. My yoga teacher, Bonnie Cretton. And my counselor. And then there have been a number of friends along the journey. Yeah. So all of those have been vital pieces of my healing.
Yeah. I would love to hear just a little bit more as you have stepped into the connection with your body through yoga, yeah, through other, you know, growth that you've done and work that you've done. What are some of the impacts that's made on a, like, just on a practical level?
Yeah. Oh, so many. I mean, one of the first things that comes to mind, right, is once I was able to begin reconnecting with my body, is then also I had to learn how to handle emotion. Because for all intents and purposes, I had attempted to murder it. And so, like, oh, I have all of these feelings. And if I'm not dissociated, I'm actually in my body, then I have to learn how to tolerate
all
these feelings, right? So that involves, I guess if you want to call it emotional fluency, the work of Brené Brown has been indispensable to my healing. But like, what is the emotion? Can I name it? How do I let it be without judging it, so that I can actually maybe listen to what it has to tell me? There is a big shift from thinking that emotion is your enemy to actually, emotion is a tool that it's like a messenger. So are you going to shoot the messenger before you ever hear the message? That's what I was doing. So like, oh wait, I have to learn to tolerate this long enough and to separate myself enough from it, have enough self-compassion that, oh, actually I am a human being. And part of being a human is having emotion. And God designed those for a purpose. It isn't an accident. That's not, I'm not trying to move beyond that, but actually live into it. Oh. And that's just that's a huge shift that had to take place. What emotions do I have? What do I do with them? What are they telling me and teaching me? How then am I going to respond? And I actually do get to respond. I don't have to live on autopilot anymore. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to be only reactionary, which is really the only models that I saw growing up, is people reacting to other people and to their emotions, not intentionally responding.
Right.
So that's a lot to learn, right? And put into practice that on its own. And one of the practical things that has come out of that specifically is that it's completely transformed the way that I parent.
Wow.
I mean, completely, right? So then I have to teach my kids about their emotions, and then I have to teach them tools in which they can tolerate those emotions and communicate those emotions with others in an effective way, not just screaming or shutting down or running away or all of those coping things. And then what do we do with those together? Because that's part of training them to be a successful adult now. And then as I have grown and learned, not just about emotions, but about so many other things, then now I can teach my kids, okay, guess what? When you were growing up, mom was depressed and anxious, and I can give them language, which is completely opposite to how I grew up, right? Making all of these connections on my own, or trying to make a story up with no tools. So, okay, give them tools, but also give them story. Okay. So here's what I was dealing with. Here was the story. Because by the way, it has been within the past, not even 5 years yet, that I finally learned my story. Because I told you that nobody in my family was talking. Well, they, I guess, were intent on just taking that to their grave until I said, hey, I'm not just going to rock the boat. I'm kicking all of us out of it, and we're going to talk about this.
Wow.
And you're going to tell me, because I have to know my own story before I can keep going. Wow. Anyway, so now that I know and have been able to start making connections, as that has happened, I'm telling my kids everything.
Yeah.
Look, this was the story. I didn't know it. Here's how I coped. Here's how that has probably affected you.
Yeah.
Tell me your experience of me.
Yeah.
And then begin to change that and heal that relationship so that there's greater trust and there's greater connection.
Right.
Between me and my kids.
Yeah.
So that I don't have to, continue this toxic cycle of miscommunication, struggle, not knowing your own story.
Yeah.
So that's one of the most practical effects.
Amazing. Can I ask, Amy? Was your family pretty willing to go there when you asked them? Or was that a bit of a point of contention when you sat down with your family and said, I need to know?
There was some resistance, and I didn't do it as a group because my family is so private that they can't. I knew that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So I went to the most willing participant first. or who I assumed, and I was right. I went to the most willing participant first.
Yeah, well, that makes
and
sense.
Said, I need to know. Here's what's going on with me and where I'm at, and I need to know some things.
Yeah.
And the resistance was, this is not my story to tell. And I said, well, no one else is talking.
Yeah.
And it's been 45 years.
Yeah, wow.
Almost. So, so it took some time for them to contemplate, to decide what they were willing to share, what they felt was still respectful to those living, et cetera. And it has slowly unfolded as I approached different family members and said, okay, here's what's happening. Will you think about talking with me about this?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, there's been some resistance, and yet enough pieces of the story that I could make probably a somewhat reliable narrative.
Yeah. Good for you, Amy. I mean, like, what you are describing, again, is not easy to do. And to really ask for that and with the resistance to approach it, you know, sort of gently. I mean, it sounds like you were firm, but also gentle and tried to be understanding of talking one-on-one and things like that. And I just can't help but think, what an amazing gift for your kids, right? Because the more and more I learn about generational trauma and things, often are skipping a generation. And I feel really passionate about this in my family. I don't have kids, but my siblings all do. And I'm in conversation with my siblings regularly of saying, we need to work on our stuff and we need to tell stories of what we know and how we've been impacted by our parents' generation and the way that we were brought up, and share that with your kids. Like, let's pass along knowledge and information to the next generation rather than all of these, like, no, we don't talk about that, or it's in the past, it doesn't matter. It's like, but it does.
It does. It's so important. Yes, I have a similar passion. Yeah, generational trauma, because of my own story and the things that have happened and continue to happen. I think, yes, that has been and continues to be a gift to my kids, and one that they're not taking lightly. So, for sure. I felt like I had no other choice. Like, if I was ever going to get to any point of healing, peace, that I had to know my story.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I mean, courage is the word that comes to mind for me as you say that. And it, if I can reflect just a moment, because again, like this idea of making life less difficult, there's like this counter belief that I have that sometimes we have to choose the difficult to ultimately get to a less difficult place. And what you're describing, like, it comes, that comes to mind of like, okay, this is going to be difficult. I'm going to choose to step into the difficulty, to go into the deep end where it's dark and potentially scary. And I don't know how it's going to come out on the other side, but the potential is like, that's where we can ultimately get to less difficult. But wow, it can be extremely difficult to get there.
For sure. I agree with that 100%, because we are only fooling ourselves if we continue to believe and walk in the way that ignoring our story and ignoring our pain is the less difficult route. Because it will kill you.
Yeah.
Quite literally.
Yeah.
And we're also fooling ourselves that we can ever achieve peace or happiness, fulfillment, well-being. Let's use that word. That we can ever achieve well-being while denying parts of ourselves. which includes story, emotions, things we don't like about ourselves, et cetera. So really I have come to see it as, yes, doing the work, diving back in. I mean, think about my work as a counselor, right? I'm encouraging people to go to their most painful places, their most vulnerable places. And many of them are not ready or will never be ready. Even if they come to counseling, it's surprising and baffling, actually, that they'll sit there on the couch and they're there and they're paying, and yet they will not go there, right? Oh, and say, like, no, I absolutely cannot open that door. Mm. And they think that that is easier.
Mm.
And yes, it does take courage, but it actually isn't the most difficult. The most difficult thing is to continue on.
Yeah. Yeah. The devastating thing is to continue on and ignore it.
Right. And again, like you were talking about generational trauma, right? You're just going to keep passing it down.
Yeah.
And then the next generation isn't even going to know what it's about.
Right.
But they're continuing to be affected by it. And that just compounds, right? The generation after generation after generation, if someone refuses to look at the hard things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think of, you said you're passionate about generational trauma, and I'd love to hear some of the things that you've read or studied. But like, I think of Gabor Mate, his story of surviving, Holocaust. I think of, Galit Atlas. She was also Jewish, and, her book on emotional, generational trauma. Mm. Anyway, there's several that I've read. Have you read either of those people?
I have not read either of them. I'll put them on my list.
Yeah. So just, they have, of course, slightly different takes on it, perspectives, and what they're trying to say with it. But, just fascinating stuff. And then another piece of my story too, talking about that generational trauma, is there's a book called What My Bones Know.
Oh, wow.
And it's an Asian American girl. And this is a whole other conversation, but it ties into my story with my dad being from Korea and his complete and utter rejection of his own racial reality.
Wow.
And that's the story for so many. Can we, like immigrants, right? Can we find a way to disappear and become normal, acceptable? Can we fit into this American culture and make a life for ourselves? And the pain and the wounding of that, and how that gets passed down, it's just fascinating to me.
I will take you up on that being another conversation, because I would love to explore that and hear more of your own journey and your dad's journey. And also, I mean, I guess just exploring a little bit more the generational trauma, because I really believe we have the opportunity to participate in generational healing.
Absolutely. And every single one of us has that.
Yeah.
Has that power.
Yeah.
And so few are taking advantage of it.
Yeah. Yeah. But to see that our living my life, doing the work in my own heart, soul, body, mind, is not just about me. It's an opportunity to influence future generations. And I, a little bit more indirectly, right? I don't have my own children, but it's like I have my nieces and nephews. I have other people's kids that I interact with, other young professionals that I work with, like to see that greater picture of the work that I do. It's not just about me. And I think that is, it's crucial for us to realize that. And I feel like, okay, do the hard work because of the greater good. And it also does, ultimately, it does make my life less difficult. right?
Yes.
So it's a win. It's making life less difficult for me. It is, though, also that opportunity to make life less difficult for others as well.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I had a conversation with a client just yesterday about that, and was encouraging her and trying to do a little refocus for her, because in so many ways with her own children, she has broken the cycle. Mm. And she wasn't seeing it. At least it didn't seem like it in the moment. She was discouraged and sad. And I stopped her and I said, "You have already told me evidence." And I listed the things that she had said to me about your own children. Mm. And they now have their own children.
Wow.
I said, "Can you see?" Can you see the ways in which you have broken the cycle?
Mm.
And she burst into tears.
Mm.
And it shifted the whole conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Because through tears, she said, "Yes, this way and this way and this way."
Awesome.
And I said, "That is an absolute miracle."
Wow.
Yeah, I'm all about that work. I'm like, yes, let me just encourage you. Let me point out ways in which, I'm really passionate about that.
Yeah.
Just gives me so much life.
it's awesome to hear these pieces of your journey, Amy, and also know you are, just very clearly working with other people, helping them along their journey, see their stories, reframe, retell, rewrite those stories, heal, pass that healing along to the future generations. It's incredibly important and sacred work. That's the word that comes up for me in this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel that. I do. And I just want to keep doing it.
Mm. Good. The world needs us and you and all of us to keep going. Right. And I think I just, as I reflect back on your story and different pieces and different, so many different things that I resonate in my own journey and story. And even though details are different, right, there's mm-hmm. those commonalities and so many other friends and people that I know and different stories that they've shared. And right, I'm seeing all those connections. And so I really want to say thank you for being willing to share these pieces of your journey, because I know that people will listen and hearing more about you will connect and resonate. And my hope is that they will, first of all, feel like they're not alone. And second of all, really think proactively, what can we do? How can we move along on the journey in a way that is going to be healing, not just for us, but for future generations as well?
Yes, for sure. And I think that my biggest hope is that, with telling my story, which it's been a privilege to be able to be asked to share it, is that I want to offer hope to people.
Yeah.
To give them a glimpse, a glimmer, actually things can change.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I can heal.
Yes.
I can, put a stop to this cycle.
Yes.
And it's possible. Yeah. I think for a long time I didn't feel that. So mm-hmm. want to offer that up as my way of helping make others' lives less difficult.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing. I would love to continue the conversation. Let's do this again, explore more.
Sounds great. Love it.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation and episode of the Make Life Less Difficult podcast. Editing is done by Joseph Burdock. Artwork is by Emma Burdock. I'd be honored if you took a moment to share this with a friend and or leave us a review. Together, I truly believe we can make life less difficult.